we actually now have somebody in the company that's like their main responsibility to stay on top of things, because it's such a, you know, fast moving market, and help the company's now portfolio to leverage it. Like, can we use it directly in the product feature wise? But we also in the marketing team are already working with a bunch of tools and testing them. And it's an exciting time. Let's see where we will be in a year or two.
Maybe in a year from now, when we have a follow-up conversation, your AI bot comes to the podcast.
Could be, yeah. Not going to be me speaking, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. So you can be on many different podcasts at the same time.
But that's going to be the main challenge, right? We're going to be flooded with content, and can be audio, video, or written content. And how can you still stand out there? And
yeah,
then I think like branding and brand awareness becomes even more important in the future.
Bonanza Growth Podcast, innovation, strategy, and UX for SaaS. Bonanza Studios is a growth consultancy for SaaS and fintech startups. Every SaaS business needs to fight in three different battles. First, product market fit, discovering a growing marketing and designing a compelling and undeniable solution to meet that demand. Second, product-led growth, turning your product into a growth vehicle by leveraging outcome-driven UX design. And third, creative marketing and organic brand building. If you're looking for a reliable partner to drive growth, check out our website at bonanza-studios.com.
Julian, back home around 5 p.m. And from 5 p.m. till 8 a.m. tomorrow, I really don't know what's going to happen. It might be that I have to be up and I would sleep 4 or 5 hours because I have to take care of things. Or I could have a really good night's sleep. It's everything up for grabs. So it's basically a Russian roulette every night.
Yeah, and this will continue for a few more years. But the good thing is it's always phases. Like, you know, when it's challenging, it's a phase. But then also there are phases where you will get some good rest and good night's sleep. So, but it's different. In hindsight, you will appreciate all the time you had before you were a father. Yeah.
How did you manage your? Because you have a 4.5 years old son, and you've been a founder. You had a successful company, Tower. One of the best examples I've. So we go way back. It's been 10 years that, you know, since we work in the same office. And I remember from those days that when you were doing Tower, we were sitting in the same office, and I was following your work. You were leveraging LinkedIn, but at that point, like 10 years ago, and you were doing something really special with marketing. So it just really stayed with me. It's like Julian knows something I don't know. So first of all, now like reflecting on what you have done, you were like using some of the best marketing practices at the time. And now fast forward, now you're part of a SaaS group. So yeah, I mean, so much has evolved in the world of marketing, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Lots of things changed. I mean, originally we started in 2010 with Tower, so even earlier, like before we met.
Yeah.
And but one thing we focused on early was content marketing, because we bootstrapped the company, so we didn't have a, you know, big marketing budget. And that's the beauty of bootstrapping. You have to be very smart about your decisions. You have to find ways to get the best out of a very limited budget or no budget at all. Usually it's your time that you invest. And back then, to be fair, content marketing was a different game. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you know, everybody picked it up. So there's much more competition. And now AI is coming into the game. So that will change everything again.
I didn't know that. So you started Tower. Tower was one of those successful products that you were competing with, what was it, GitHour, like another product competitor that it was a bit bigger than you guys, but you guys...
But we had one competitor back, like when we initially launched, it was pretty much, so Tower, for the ones that don't know, is a Git client. So if you use version control and work with Git, for example, with GitHub, GitLab, and so on, and you don't want to use it through their web interface or via the command line, yeah, you can use Tower. And back then, there wasn't a desktop GUI, just an open source solution. So we started coding Tower, and with a very limited amount of time, because we pretty much did it on, we did some agency work on the side, and then we just had to put the 1.0 out. So it was really like, you know, this typical saying, if you're embarrassed of the 1.0, we definitely were. There were lots of bugs and features missing and so on, but we just were running out of money. And we then had a few competitors. Like, one was called SourceTree. They got acquired by Atlassian. Then GitHub launched their own client, GitHub Desktop, and a few others popped up over the years. But I think we were fortunate enough to build a community, actually turn Tower into a brand, and so we're able to, you know, it's, we sold the company 2.5 years ago, but it's still growing. The everybody from the original team, except me and Toby, our CEO, is still with the company, and so it's nice to see that the product, even after over a decade, is still evolving and growing.
So right now I can take it to 5 different directions. You already planted a lot of seeds in me, but like, let's just like touch base on the earlier point that you mentioned, and I can resonate with that a lot as well, because Bonanza Studios is a bootstrap company. We started trying to find the cash flow first, then, you know, invest in the business. So whatever we make, we invest back into the business. What's the difference in strategy or difference in approaches you see between bootstrap companies and companies that are venture funded when it comes to marketing?
So when you're venture funded, you obviously can have a different marketing strategy. You can invest, and then your return on that investment can be a year or two down the line. So you can say, okay, I'm investing X, I'm expecting this conversion, and this is going to be the lifetime value, but only 2 years down the road. But that's okay, because I have this runway. If you're bootstrapped, it, you know, you need like almost an immediate return on your invest, and so that's a big difference. So and so you also try to find ways that you invest once, like let's say content marketing, SEO, like you invest work, but then it brings you long-time benefits, versus PPC, you know, performance marketing. As soon as you stop spending the money, the traffic also stops coming to your website. So that's why we, for the first few years, for example, didn't do any Google ads, and then we maybe spent like $500 a month, like very, very, very low budget, and never really scaled these channels, but rather tried to attract organic traffic, invest in branding, build a community. And so it's just the amount of risk you can take, and the pretty much your roadmap, how quickly you need to generate revenue.
I mean, I recognize that there are merits in paid ads and artificial growth, so to speak. That's how I call it, right? So there is merits to it. It's expedited growth. It's done properly, but in a given, I run a bootstrap business, I had to really invest in brand building and organic growth through content, right? But it's a, I think it's two different it's a different dynamics if you have, for example, 1 million, 2 million in your bank account already from day one, versus having nothing in your bank account. And it requires you to set to employ a set of different strategies when it comes to growing the business. And I've seen companies on each camp succeed, and I've seen both companies on each camp fail. So what's your take? Like, you know, if you were to go back to day zero and want to start the new business, let's say in 5 years, would you still like invest in organic brand building or employ a mixed approach? What's your take?
So it depends on the market. I don't think you can generally say I'm going this or this direction. It really depends on the market, the competition, how quickly do you want to get market share, how much time do you have. But I would probably do a mixed approach. That's what we also do with our companies at SAS Group now. Mm-hmm. So we invest a lot in content, SEO, but we also invest quite a bit in performance marketing and other paid channels. Mm-hmm. So, and as you said, like both ways can work or can fail. Mm-hmm. We've seen both. There's also one other thing aspect we haven't talked about. If you bring in venture capital, somebody else suddenly owns a part of your company. That's probably the main, would be the main decision point for me. So it would really depend on who that person is. Is there maybe also, already a history, lots of trust? Because I've also seen both, where people get like an initial funding that helps them to accelerate and just get off the ground quicker. Mm-hmm. And some companies end up not even using all of the money they raised because they found it smart ways to grow organically, and others where, you know, things don't turn out well. So we see a lot of companies now with SAS Group. So we primarily acquire bootstrap businesses, mm-hmm. but lately due to the change in the market and the funding market, we're also looking at companies that raised some venture capital, but now might face challenges to raise another round. Mm-hmm. And often when we talk to these founders, they actually want to go back. they would like to turn the wheel back and be like, hey, I want to go back and actually focus on profitability. And that's often what they did. And then maybe they made it to $1 million in ARR, but then, you know, they thought they could reach 2, 3, 4, 5 million quicker if they would raise a round, which can work, but often doesn't. And then quite often there's a culture clash. Founders actually being put on the side, and you know, they hire like a more experienced CEO, and then things really change. It also depends. Like the reason we started Tower was I worked at a bigger company at Universal Music, and my co-founder as well was a bit tired of politics, and we wanted to build a work environment where we actually enjoyed working. So it mm-hmm. wasn't so much about let's build the next big thing, because to be honest, then, you know, we should have done something else. But actually build a company where we enjoy working at, and where we have a great culture, a culture of respect. And the team, like most of the team has been with us for like so many years, like up to, you know, 10 years. And I think that speaks for itself. And even in the past, when they got offers from bigger companies like Apple and so on, who obviously would pay bigger salary, they're like, it's actually not worth it. Like almost half of the team works in a 4-hour week. Most of them are parents by now. So that, you know, was like work-life balance was a big impact for them. But you can still, sometimes you hear this word lifestyle business when it comes to these. Yeah. And I think that doesn't do it justice. It's still a serious business, everybody puts in their best effort, but in a way where, yeah, in a environment where there's ideally no politics, you don't have to, you know, waste 20% of your energy to position yourself within the company and so on.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I resonate with that. I think lifestyle businesses, they offer something that big companies, they don't. They allow you to explore your own lifestyle, right? You know, if one goes to Apple, they have to really adhere to their way of work. You don't have so much freedom. You don't have to, probably you have less time to spend with your family or go around the world or do whatever you want. So it's at the end of the day, I think any career decision is a trade-off between what I'm getting and what I'm losing. like as a right. And I think, and I will say that our own company too, Julian, is that we've got designers that they could easily go work with a bigger company and make almost double, but they stay because they gain financial freedom, creative freedom. They have their own, they have a lot of control over their lifestyle. And they can travel around. So I think there are a lot of gains. And I think it's often not respected by executives of bigger companies. They think they can buy everything with money, but especially in today's workforce, they are way educated about their needs than we think. I think that's just a fact.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're more vocal about it, which is great. Like I see that a lot in we're hiring a lot of interviews in the last year, and it's great to see that candidates feel comfortable enough to actually share that, and don't hold that back. I think it's changing a little bit. Like the pandemic helped. Like suddenly companies were forced to go remote, and then they started hiring remote, testing that. But quite a few are now, you know, backpedaling, trying to bring people back into the office, more control. So it's something I think you have to learn. Like it's trust is super important and can be challenging as a manager or the leader of a company to really trust into your people. But so we now have colleagues in 28 countries, you know, and so many time zones. So you just have to trust that, you know, it's about the output and not when exactly they work, where they are. I don't know. but this takes a bit of time. And what I also, in my team now, we have people, you know, in Europe, Asia, Africa, also depends on your cultural background. Like, mm-hmm. How were you raised? What's expected in the society you live in or your previous jobs. So we often, for example, we have an unlimited vacation policy, but you have to take at least 24 days because often with unlimited vacation, then nobody wants to be the person that actually takes time off. And some people we really have to like force to even take these 24 days. And for them, it's just because they're just not used to it. The previous country, either the country or the culture or the company. So it's always interesting to see. I think it's also on the manager to really, you know, you can write all these things on your website and they sound great, but you actually need to live them and sometimes also enforce them and live by example as well.
I mean, something, you know, we're sort of a global company too, and we hire from any culture, right? You know, any country. So as long as certain things are met, you know, we try to find talent. So, and that's our priority, and talent and character. So as long as these two met, we are open to hire. And so I've been reflecting on this a lot, you know, 50 years ago, if you had a company in Berlin, you were forced by geographical determination to hire from your surroundings. Like you did not have so much options. Like, you know, there was no technology enabling you. But now in this global marketplace, I think hiring teams, hiring managers, they have this option to hire from any part of the world. And consequently, it's basically cultures. Countries with solid cultures could win this career competition, so to speak. This, and what I mean by that is that, for example, I love Japanese culture. There are some of the most reliable people I've seen. They have a high level of accountability and reliability is part of their norms, right? So then it's actually a great cultural study for hiring managers as well. You get to know different cultures in the world and understand what they stand for, what their merits are, what their values are. And it's a beautiful thing. Like, you know, you expand your knowledge of the world and different cultures that exist and thrive today.
Yeah, I always call it traveling without traveling. Like, that's what I loved about traveling. Like, my wife and I, we traveled a lot around the globe, and just, you know, diving into new cultures, getting to know new people, learning about things. And now you can do this partially, obviously, being, you know, there is always different. But I really enjoy this, like having a very diverse team and learning something new pretty much every day.
You mentioned something that I would like to take you back to that point, is that you see companies, SaaS businesses especially, get to 1 million ARR, and then at this inflection point, so to speak, they decide, well, very logical as well, okay, if we got to ARR, 1 million ARR by ourselves organically, if we raise, we can boost our growth. But seems like this logical reasoning may be counterproductive to their growth. So what's the disconnect here? What happens here that stops them from growing further, although they have more money in their bank account?
Quite often it's losing focus, because suddenly you have the opportunity. You know, you look at your bank account and it's like, oh, we can do all these things we actually wanted to do. And then they start, I don't know, sponsoring conferences, investing in these channels and these, but not like really focusing on a channel and really figuring out how to make it work and then scaling it. Sometimes what we also see is that these companies were initially product-led growth companies. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, listened to their customers, implemented their feedback, added features and so on. And then they raise money, and then often it's like, hey, we should invest in sales, like a, you know, hire head of sales, maybe a sales team, do outreach, cold outreach, and so on. And that's a totally different game. Sometimes this can be the right decision. Maybe, you know, depending on the market you're in, you kind of like plateaued for this product-led growth. And this can, we have companies in our portfolio where, like, thanks to sales, suddenly, like, they've been growing steadily, but sales is just accelerating it. Mm-hmm. So that's great. But for others, that's the total opposite. And then it can also, you know, bring a change in culture, that suddenly there's push to hire different kind of people, maybe. And then they can clash with the team you already built. And then you no longer have like one united front that works on the same goal.
And what would be like your recommendation for such companies? Like, do they need to stay still in the bootstrapping mode? And is there a point that they could consider raising, or they will be better off to be bootstrapping as long as it takes?
I think you have to sit down and really think about, why am I doing this? Like, what's the reasoning and what's my goal? So do I want, you know, to become rich like quickly, and that's the end goal, and I'm willing to take a big risk? Or am I building a long-term business, and at the end you actually might end up with more money with that long-term business? But you know, and it's okay for me if it takes longer and it's like a more healthy organic growth, or also the market, like, which market am I in? Do I have to react quickly? Markets can change. So maybe yesterday it was totally fine to have that slow, steady growth. Suddenly you have a competition that's very aggressive in terms of pricing, product, and you're pretty much forced to react. So really sit down and think about what's more important. Also, full ownership of strategy, the company, the team, or parting ways with part of that. at the same time, it can make sense to bring in expertise, like to get some, you know, smart venture money, not just any capital, but actually capital that due to network and expertise can help you boost the business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm with you on this. At the end of the days, it comes down to the founders' aspirations and values. You know, what do I want to get out of this? And I think, you know, I've talked to folks that at the point that are thinking about exiting and getting acquired, and they feel sort of like not bad, but sort of like they don't feel necessarily good about it. It's like, I don't know if I'm going to sell it. What I will say to them is like, it's absolutely okay if you want to sell your company. It has nothing wrong with it. It's actually sometimes a company is better off to be sold because it goes to a bigger home, and that bigger home and bigger space, there is more room for growth, right? So if your mission is to really help a target audience, and you think that, okay, by basically moving from one smaller house to bigger house, you can accelerate that growth and help more people, then I think, why not? But I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to the founder's aspirations and value.
And they will change over time, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, let's say when you start your business, and let's say we have that conversation again in 5 to 7 years, then maybe you're like, okay, I've done this for, you know, over a decade, and there can be multiple reasons that you would like to do something else. Let's say you want to start a new project, or you're just no longer so passionate about it, which I think is okay after, you know, putting a lot of time in it. There can be health reasons. I know lots of founders that, you know, either were affected by burnout or very near to it, that say like, hey, I want to get out. And others that just say, yes, okay, I'm now at a point, maybe I want to, you know, I have a family, I want a little bit more financial freedom, so I actually want to sell the business and just to have that in the bank account and then do something else. And I think everything is totally, totally fine, as long as it, like, in your own interest.
Yeah, 100% on this. It's so crucial for founders to know what they want and to be clear and unapologetic about their needs and aspirations, and don't shy away from saying no or yes when they think they have to say no or yes. I think it's business, nothing personal.
Yeah, it's probably also has to do with the way the tech community celebrates exits versus just running a profitable business for many, many years. Like, sometimes you have the feeling the only company you read about is, you know, 37 Signals or now Basecamp. I guess, okay, they bootstrapped and they're still doing it, and that's awesome. But there's so many great small to medium-sized businesses that are profitable. And I think that's an amazing achievement. If you sell it, I think that's also an achievement. But I don't think one is like better than the other. But sometimes it in the press, it feels like it. I wish there would be a bit more coverage just about. Actually, 30 Second Signals, they used to have the podcast, or was a written interview series, Bootstrap, Profitable, and Proud, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Where they interviewed companies that crossed 1 million in ARR and just by bootstrapping it. And I always really enjoyed reading about these.
Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of folks out there having a very decent business. They don't necessarily go on LinkedIn and write a post about, here are my tips about launching a seven-figure business. They really do care about their own business, their team, their clients, their family, and necessarily they don't want to get out there and talk about things. I think being as a founder, having a sense of boundaries, having a decent, healthy level of privacy, it really helps you for your own mental health. I mean, I would say not to put your ego on the on the front all the time, and just, you know, try to have a normal life here and there, and enjoy your time with your family. I think that's very healthy.
I mean, for some, it works. It's pretty much their marketing strategy, right? They're like the face of the company. They're out there. They're on Twitter. They're on LinkedIn. They're on podcasts. And that's the way they build the brand and actually drive the business. And I think it can make sense. Sometimes you have the feeling, okay, maybe it would have helped if they would actually focus more on the business side of things. But it's a case by case.
You mentioned something about community, building communities and brand building. Maybe like walk us through why it's such an important key to drive growth, investing in community and employing strategies for organic building, especially for SaaS businesses.
So, you know, features can be copied. Pricing can can always price their product cheaper. Mm-hmm. But branding and building a community, having ambassadors, like very loyal customers that recommend your business, growing via word of mouth. So this can easily set you apart or give you an advantage if you have a competitor that's maybe, you know, just able to spend more money on Google Ads. And so that's what we noticed with Tower. Even what I love is that it's, you know, we're like a small team, and but no matter where we went, usually if you met a software developer, they at least had heard of it. Mm. And maybe they, you know, they don't use it for like various reasons, but just was like, oh, cool, they've heard of it. And every time that wasn't the case, then we became nervous and was like, okay, we have to double down again on getting the word out there. And that just really helped. So we also did some, you know, fun side projects that had nothing to do with the product, but were more for our audience. Like back in the day, we heavily focused actually on design heavy illustrations that like set us apart. So we always made sure it looked nice and not the same repetitive, you know, illustration that where, you know, usually when you go to a SaaS website, they look like all the same, or 90% of them, and you can't really tell them apart. And then we also did some fun project like many years ago, maybe like 10 years ago, we did like an illustrated history of macOS, because the majority of our users were Apple users. And back then, for the ones that don't know, Apple always had like a cat as a name, like, and so Tiger and Snow Leopard and so on. And so we just illustrated all of them and made a nice landing page, turned that into posters, shirts, and so on. And this really went viral also with an Apple, who was always one of our biggest customers. And so this helps. Sometimes then I reach out to journalists that hadn't heard about the product, but they were like, oh, I've seen, you know, for example, this, and we've done many of these projects. Or a few years ago, I realized that all these open source tech projects, they also all have animals, you know, it's like the Firefox and PHP as the elephant and so on, but they're not so beautiful usually. And so we just redesigned all of them and then did the same thing. And then we turned it into merch, and then we donated the proceeds to open source projects. And so even with that, we wrote a manifesto, a developer manifesto. And we then initially we just you could download it as a PDF and as a wallpaper. And it was also for us to build our newsletter list, kind of like a lead magnet. But people were like, I would love to, like, you know, put this on my wall. So we started printing them as posters, and and then suddenly we got orders from, like, you know, big companies. So I know they've been in offices, like, you know, Dropbox, everywhere. Like, the posters are there, your domain is there. It's kind of like branding. And and the first month, you can also make money off it. Like, the first month we sold the shirts and the posters, we made 10,000 just off that merch. And and then we're able to invest just that money again to, you know, hand out free merch, for example. So kind of like So just being, because we also wanted to have some fun in between, you know, we have this product, it's a very techy product. How can you make it fun? Or how do I get publications to write about us that would never write about a Git client, you know, or maybe once, like you initially launch, but they don't care about your next major version. So you have to find different angles to then be featured by them and still get a backlink and a mention of your product and just get in the face of these. And many of these things you can automate. You set up a Shopify store connected to a service like Printful, like print on demand, and you pretty much have nothing to do with it. And so that's, yeah, we try to always do some of these fun projects in between.
I still remember your landing page, the homepage, because your landing page, homepage was far away. Like it was just like you could just like load up your homepage and have it as a screen saver or something. Right, so it was just I still remember the vibe and look and your homepage. It was like an airport, a plane goes through it, something like this. I don't remember the details of it, but I guess that's the power of branding, that you could remember what that brand looks and feels and it's become part of your memory. And also you mentioned something about having fun and being creative when it comes to marketing your product. I would like to get your take on this and elaborate a bit more on the importance of being creative with your marketing activities in order to capture demand.
Yeah, so we are very, you know, we come from the Apple world, so all of the teams like very design driven. So it's not only these fun illustration projects, but also when it comes to UI, UX design, we're like very cautious about it. And so there are many reasons. It also makes it easier to hire, you know, great designers, for example. If you tell them the only thing you will do is design a Git client from now on, it's like, okay, you know, challenges, interesting, but
yeah.
But if they already know, like, oh, we also do like all these other things where I can totally have creative freedom and go beyond what I would do in the day-to-day business. We did so many things over the years where we often just got inspired, to be honest. Just, you know, you see something, you're like, hey, how could we somehow like transition this to, for example, as a kid, we always played these card games where you, let's say, with cars, and then it was like, okay, my car has like more horsepower than yours, right? And I was like, maybe we could do this like for programming languages, like programming languages, and who has like, you know, more contributors, or when did the project launch? How many commits does it have? And so we did. So it was called the Nerdy Game of Cards. We designed it with, you know, PHP, Ruby, like all these. We also obviously put Git in there, even though it's not a programming language. And then we found a company where that prints cards, and then we had a couple hundred printed. And then people were going crazy for these. Like we brought them along. Let's say we went to a conference or. We just did, you know, giveaways, and because it was something different, probably same thing. Somebody started it with socks many years ago, but now, you know, everybody seems to have socks. But already taking something that people actually know, so we immediately know what to do with it, because most of them, like at least our age, played these kind of card games, so our audience, and then transferring it to whatever. Niche you are in, that's always been great, and it also helped us, as you mentioned, you know, being creative and having no budget. It's like we didn't have a budget to sponsor conferences, you know, there were thousands or sometimes $10,000 of dollars, and we're like, So you still get these requests, like once you reach a certain site, you get emails. It's like, hey, want to sponsor like this US conference and so on. And then I was just like honest. I was like, hey, we're bootstrapping the business, like we don't have the budget, but it would. You know, we'd love to support you. can we do something else? And then we often, for example, we have a cheat sheet about Git. That's something that developers often use. So you pretty much have like the most important commands on it. So we designed that. We had it online to grow our newsletter list. But then you just print it, you know, 1,000 or 2,000. That's actually then not that expensive. And then you offer the the conference layer. I'll ship you 500 or 700. How many? Depending how many visitors you have. And in that scenario, we sponsored a lot of conferences without actually. Yes, we did have to spend some money, but not just, you know, you spend 5K and then your logo is on a badge. I still don't believe in these kind of sponsorings, but rather giving the visitor some value, something to take home with.
I mean, it's so cool that you talk about this, because I see a lot of companies, especially the ones that raise money, they print merch and, you know, hats and socks and t-shirts and hats and you name it, fridge pins and blah, blah, blah. But I think what please correct me if I am going off the path, is that the difference between your approach and their approach is that you add a layer of creativity on top of all your campaigns that sort of like excite and charm your audience, rather than crudely just print stuff and put your logo and brands on top of a merch and send it to whoever.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, most people don't want to wear a logo, right? Like some, maybe if it's really their favorite software ever, but if it's something creative, like actually that they're proud wearing, and then it happens to be, you know, from your company or somehow involves your company and product, then that's ideal. So either have the creative and fun aspect, or what we really focused on is bring them value. Like we wrote a whole book that we published, or you know, these cheat sheets, for example, they actually bring them value. They put them on their desk when they learn version control and can actually work with it. And so, yeah, it's not just another shirt with a logo on it.
Content marketing and organic growth. I think that needs to be considered and as a main primary strategy for especially B2B SaaS companies to drive growth. You can only rely on paid ads and artificial growth to a certain extent. So going all the way from 2010, when you started Tower, and being like, I mean, I wish our audience would, they noticed you at that point, so they would understand what I experienced being close to you in the same office. Going from 2010 all the way to 2024 and 23. Well, 23 is about to be over, so we always look for 2024 and how we can. Because whatever we are doing marketing right now, I'm actually aiming for 2024. 2023, our potential clients, they made their commercial decisions most likely, and they are basically wrapping up the year and try to bring home the projects. And so what I'm trying to do with our own marketing is to basically be on top of their list for 2024, right? So going from 2010 to 2023 and eyeing for 2024, if you want to reflect on best practices when it comes to organic brand building and the evolution of content marketing, what are the best practices that you used that are not working anymore? And if you were to, for example, advise SaaS businesses about best practices now, what would be those, and what should they do, and what should they not do, especially not do? Because a lot of you know it better than me, a lot of SaaS businesses flushing money down the toilet when it comes to their marketing, and they don't know they really rely on their generating MQLs and leads, and they don't know why their sales cycle are lengthy or customer acquisition costs are high, and although they have a lot of leads. So if you want to like reflect on your journey and go all the way from 2010 to 2023, what are those best practices? How they should put together a marketing engine business, SaaS businesses right now to drive growth?
So to be fair, and as you already said, things that worked 10 years ago no longer work, or it's much more challenging to get them to work these days.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, I'll give you a different answer in 2-3 months, depending on how the AI tools evolve. I think we'll see SEO and content marketing currently in a fluctuating state. So let's see where the where this is going. But looking back, things that we did right. So maybe starting with that, what I'm often surprised at when we look at companies that we want to acquire is that they maybe leverage some platforms, let's say LinkedIn or Twitter, but there you never fully own your audience, right? A few people on, you know, especially brands that bet on Twitter, they're now learning this, people abandoning ship, and suddenly you don't get maybe the same reach anymore that you used to get. And most of them don't have a newsletter. They maybe message their customers onboarding sequence if they're lucky. But so my number one recommendation still would be to build a newsletter, because you fully own that that audience. And even in 2023 and 2024, I think it's still very valuable to be in somebody's inbox, even so they're crowded. Mm-hmm. But there, actually be smart about it, not just send out a newsletter for the sake of keeping your rhythm, but actually provide value. So that's what we did. And we scaled the newsletter like over 100,000 subscribers. That's, you know, with open rate is not a good metric anymore now with Apple's new privacy policies. But if you look at the click-through rate and so on, so if it's an engaging audience, then that's still super important and valuable. Mm-hmm. And if it comes to content, pretty much the same thing with like the fun projects. Keep your eyes open and see if there's anything that you could also do on your side. So we had, it's like a long time ago, but back then, for example, we just launched like a bunch of FAQs around Git, like our topic. And this just took off. Like we have FAQs that drive like 20, 30,000 visitors per month, still like years after writing this.
Wow.
And then, you know, you bring value, you answer the question what they have, but then you can also be on, by the way, if you want to do it in an interface, then Tower lets you do it this and this. Or lots of companies want to do webinars, but what they actually then, so they record a webinar, they put it out there, and then no signups. It's like, okay, how do we actually get traffic? Then they start using, you know, testing LinkedIn paid, which can become very expensive depending which niche you're in. So what we try to build is like a constant stream of traffic that's already like highly targeted, and then we try to convert that traffic. This can be, you know, as simple as downloading a cheat sheet and then you're part of an email automation, or you join our webinars and you're part of an email automation. And as a small team, and you have to be smart about it, so you just automate everything. So we have a webinar, I don't even know, I think like every week, but it's all automated. It's pre-recorded. You use the software. We use Demio, but there are many other solutions to set it up. And once you have attracted this traffic, then, you know, people participate, then we have an email automation set up, check, are they already a customer? Yes, no. And then depending on that, they go down a different funnel. And for that, just having this traffic and content is still super important. Mm-hmm. In terms of the type of content, yes, that really depends. You really have to do your research. What's the competition doing? and really, really take SEO into consideration, and not just the basics, but actually, ideally getting very good at SEO or working with somebody, hiring somebody that's good at SEO. This can just make a massive difference. There are so many, still so many mistakes made, and actually staying on top of that and leveraging that. That's also very important.
And what's your take on LinkedIn as a vehicle for growth? And I don't necessarily mean paid LinkedIn, because, but LinkedIn as a platform and also podcasting.
I think both can work if you stick with it. So that's also often something we see, that people just, you know, that try something, it's like, not working, but you know, need to have, you know, give it time. And often also when you try to explain SEO to people, it's like, hey, this is going to take like 6 months, right? At least, to come into effect. Same thing if you start with content, it's not like suddenly your blog will explode, but pretty much every successful company you talk to that made one of these channels work, podcasting, LinkedIn, whatever, their answer will be consistency and actually sticking with it, sticking it through the hard times. Yes, you know, at one point there might be a point where you're like, okay, I gave my best, I gave it a shot for a certain amount of time and it's not working. Or a channel at one point might just be saturated, so you have to move on. But I think it can really work, and I think there are lots of examples where that works. And podcasting, for example, because developers were our audience, and so we knew they love to listen to podcasts, especially back then. So we couldn't really sponsor many podcasts, you know, due to limited budget. So we just went on as many podcasts as possible as a guest, and that's even idea. You get to tell your story and so on. Yeah. And so this can still be, it's time consuming, but it can still be a good channel. And same with LinkedIn. I think the difference here is, especially also when you, once you have a team, is it like branding towards the product and the company, or personal marketing, like personal branding? So like LinkedIn, I see you like, oh, Barrett, he's like, you know, super expert UX, UI design and so on. Or do I always like connected with your company? Because at one point, well, not in your case, you're the founder, but let's say a key person of your team leaves, then they will take their audience with them.
Right.
Always a bit of a challenge, but to be honest, personal marketing always works better. You know, it seems more trustworthy when you see a post from a company.
That's right. That's right. Julian, I would like to end this conversation getting your take on how to approach marketing, especially in this, imagine this situation that you get hired as a growth marketer or whatever. And what do you have to do in the first, for example, 3 months of your you know, early days? Like, what are the steps you should be taking as a marketer, as a growth specialist, to sort of like get onboarded properly and start driving growth? Like, how would you approach this?
Depends a bit of the state of the business. Like, where are they at? Are you just starting off, or is it actually already an ongoing business? At the beginning, I think it's very important also as a marketer to learn as much as possible about the product or service, like in your case, to fully understand the customers or clients, maybe listen in on sales calls, customer calls, work for a while. Lots of companies do this. They pretty much like force new hires to work in customer support for, let's say, a couple of weeks to see, okay, how do they actually communicate? You know, what's the questions they have? What's the profile like? And then once you have a good idea, start defining your audience. Like, what's your ideal customer look like? And then think about, where are they? Where can you find them? How can you reach them? Instead of just, you know, blindly starting to to launch marketing efforts and trying to be really smart about it. Obviously, getting, if you're just starting out, getting the basics in place. But once that's done, trying to focus also on one or two channels and really mm-hmm. put all your efforts there, give them a chance instead of trying to, you know, everything at once, but nothing yeah. really good, then you're probably going to have mediocre results.
So basically learning about the product, about the market and customers first, and then really try to find channels, the channels with the most potential, and focus on those first rather than spreading out your energy and try to maintain many channels.
Yeah, so obviously you have to, like, often, like, one thing marketers neglect, we call that reputation marketing. Uh-huh. All these review sites like G2, Capterra, you know, Trustpilot, you name it. So that's what I mean with basics. You should have a profile on each of these. If they're relevant for you, then work closely with customer support to get an initial set of 5-10 reviews. So because they do show up in the search results, and then, you know, there should be not no star or one star on these platforms. So that's what I mean with basics. Immediately start, like, coming up with ways, like, when you manage to attract traffic, even if it's just a few visits, trying to somehow convert that into a subscriber, like an email, and somehow keeping them and being able to reach out to them again, and not just like the visiting, bouncing, and they're mm-hmm. gone. So this really right. doing it from day one, and not, because you never really know when things are going to really take off. And let's say you manage to have this one content piece that then takes off, but then you don't have any lead magnet to actually capture the audience that suddenly floods your website. And then testing channels, you know, maybe for some Quora still works. Like for a long time, we focused on Quora and just answered as many questions as possible. Or Reddit, like, depending on the audience, like, can you mm-hmm. be active in subreddits? So pretty much divide your time into, first get the basics right, then focus a big chunk of your time on 1 to 2 channels, and then allocate some time for testing, like, smaller channels mm-hmm. To see if you can also have some quick wins there.
Really appreciate this. Very valuable. Like, I mean, my notebook is packed with notes right now. Appreciate your coming by. I hope you, I don't know what's your take on AI. I hope you become friends with AI and ChatGPT. Are you using ChatGPT, or is it part of the strategy of the SaaS group to sort of leverage AI?
Yes, absolutely. It's becoming a big focus of ours. We actually now have somebody in the company that's, like, their main responsibility to stay on top of things, because it's such a, you know, fast moving market, and help the companies in our portfolio to leverage it. Like, can we use it directly in the product feature wise? But we also in the marketing team are already working with a bunch of tools and testing them. And it's an exciting time. Let's see where we will be in a year or two.
Maybe in a year from now, when we have a follow-up conversation, your AI bot comes to the podcast.
Could be, yeah. That's not going to be me speaking. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can be on many different podcasts at the same time.
That's going to be the main challenge, right? We're going to be flooded with content, and it can be audio, video, or written content. And how can you still stand out there? And
yeah,
then I think, like, branding and brand awareness becomes even more important in the future.
How so?
Well, to stand out, to still be recognizable, and not just have, you know, everybody can now produce 100 blog posts a day if they want to with AI.
Yeah.
But if that's really the best approach, that's debatable.
Thanks a lot. I know that your time is valuable, and we've been going back and forth a lot to make this happen. It finally happened, and I'm really happy that we had this conversation.
Thank you for the invite.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode. For more information, go to bonanza-studios.com.